Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Jai. So today's Rukmini's appearance day, so I've been asked to give a class about that. But I also prepared the Bhagavatam class, today's verse, which I'm not going to do. But since I prepared it, and rather let all that preparation go in vain, I'm going to say a little something about it. So if you look over on the board there, that's a picture of Krishna taking birth. Oh, yeah. No, it is. It's a picture of Krishna taking birth, and I'll explain. Krishna is being born in that young lady's life. Okay? I don't think anybody would disagree with that. What you're looking at is a young lady that came up to the book table that we have up at the observatory, and she took those books. Jai Kush, Bhakta Jai Kush distributed those books to her. I think he said there's like 23 or 24 books in that bag. She's got a double plastic bag there with 24 Srila Prabhupada's books in it. So I don't think anybody could deny that Krishna's taking birth in her life. Okay? And in today's purport, if I would have read it, it talks about how Vasudev, Krishna went from the body of Vasudev to the body of Devaki, not by the normal human means. In other words, not by seminal injection. Prabhupada actually used the word diksha. He referred to that as diksha. And he was transferred, Krishna was transferred from the mind of Vasudev to the mind of Devaki, and he referred to it as diksha. So diksha, what is diksha really? Diksha is somebody who has Krishna, gives Krishna, and somebody gets Krishna, you see? So that was how, you know, Prabhupada was explaining the birth of Krishna in today's verse. And that's what's happening here. This, you know, somebody's giving Krishna, and she's getting Krishna. And the point I wanted to make was that this is very important. This is very important. This is very significant. Nobody, I don't think any devotee in this room would, you know, deny that or disagree with that point, that this is a very significant and important thing. And in the first Back to Godhead, so basically initiation, which is what's happening here, is not a formality. You know, in the first Back to Godhead magazine I ever read, and Judah Karma is my witness, because he also read this. He remembers he read this same Back to Godhead. Some devotees were on a morning walk with Prabhupada, and they asked him, Prabhupada, when can we become initiated? You know, and they were thinking in terms of the formal initiation. But Prabhupada's answer was, you are already initiated. As soon as one becomes serious to follow my instructions, that is initiation. So it's a lot more than just a formality. So in our movement, you know, we tend to emphasize the role of there's three different types of gurus. There's a Diksha Guru, there's a Shiksha Guru, and there's a Vartma Padakshana Guru. And generally what's emphasized in our movement is the Diksha Guru, you know, the one who actually formally gives an initiation, and the Shiksha Guru. And the role of the Vartma Padakshana Guru is generally not very much appreciated or well known, but it's actually very important. See, this is what actually we're a movement. Oh, we're meant to be a movement of Vartma Pradakshana Gurus, and that's what Lord Chaitanya meant when he gave that instruction, Yade Deke Tade Kaha Krishna Upadesh Amada Agyaya Guruhana Tade Desh, which Prabhupada quoted about 12 times in his Gaur Purnim lecture in Mayapur. I think it was Sura read it one year, 1975 or 6. He quoted that verse about 12 times in the course of that lecture. So that's something that, you know, that's obviously that's what this means. You know, that's what that verse means. Become a Vartma Pradakshana Guru. Vartma Pradakshana means one who introduces one to the path. You see, this is important. This is important. This is diksha, and this is being a guru, and this is what we're all about. You know, as I said, Krishna taking birth. Krishna's taking birth in this young lady's life. And the other point I wanted to make was that, so when you see a picture like this, if you're not like, you know, a book distributor, quote unquote a book distributor, nobody should feel like, well, I don't feel good because, you know, I don't do books. Everybody's doing book distribution. The point I wanted to make is this. At the moment, we have 8 devotees on the Sankirtan party, 4 young men and 4 old men. I'm one of the old men, Sachit Anoy. And we have 2 premas, Gauranga Prema and Sankirtan Prema, or Prema Sankirtan. He wouldn't like to hear this, but he's an old man too. But these four young men who have joined, they didn't join a warehouse. You know, they didn't join a book warehouse. You know, they came because they came and they saw a temple community. They came to a temple with all sorts of things going on, like what we just experienced over the last half hour here. You know, nice deity worship, devotees who are obviously enthusiastically cooperating and appreciating each other. That's what attracts people to join and want to become part of the whole thing. Am I right or wrong? Here's one of them. Am I right or wrong? Yeah, they didn't join a warehouse. They joined the temple community. So it's very important. And everybody who's here and is, you know, enthusiastically participating, who's participating in, you know, this, what Prabhupada's given us, ISKCON, the basic program, getting up early, coming to Mangalarti, doing your service and everything. You're contributing to book distribution, because we wouldn't have book distributors unless we have a temple community that's doing all these other things that Prabhupada has said we should be doing. So that's basically it. That was the gist of the class. So as I said, I didn't want to waste that preparation, so I thought I'd just show you this. And this is, once again, last point. This is not an isolated incident. This is going on a regular daily basis. You know, several times a day, sometimes as many as like a dozen times a day, maybe sometimes three, four, five, six times a day. But there are people who, as you can see, who are appreciating. They're ready to get Krishna. They're ready to receive Krishna. So we have to be ready to go out there and give him Krishna. There's people out there ready to receive it. And it's not like the old days, it's just like a bunch of hippies or something like that. We're talking about, at least what our experience has been from where we're distributing, is it's people from all different parts of the world, all different educational backgrounds, all different like ages, all different sizes and shapes and colors, you name it, they're interested. It's just that's where it's at. It's ripe. There's people, you know, of every different size, shape and description who are interested and ready to receive Krishna in their lives. And we have to somehow or other get out there and just make sure they get it. Okay, so the remainder of this class, I'm going to read the chapter 60 of the Krishna book entitled The Talks Between Krishna and Rukmini. And I'll read as much as I can until the class finishes. Okay. Once upon a time, Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the bestower of all knowledge upon all living entities, from Brahma to the insignificant ant, was sitting in the bedroom of Rukmini, who was engaged in the service of the Lord, along with her assistant maidservants. Krishna was sitting on the bedstead of Rukmini, and the maidservants were fanning him with chamaras, yak-tail fly whisks. Lord Krishna's dealings with Rukmini as a perfect husband are a perfect manifestation of the supreme perfection of the Personality of Godhead. There are many philosophers who propound the concept of the absolute truth in which God cannot do this or that. They deny the incarnation of God or the supreme absolute truth in human form. But actually, the fact is different. God cannot be subject to our imperfect sensual activities. He is the all-powerful, omnipresent personality of Godhead. And by his supreme will, he can not only create, maintain, and annihilate the whole cosmic manifestation, but also descend as an ordinary human being to execute the highest mission. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, whenever there are discrepancies in the discharge of human occupational duties, he descends. He is not forced to appear by any external agency, but he descends by his own internal potency in order to reestablish the standard functions of human activities and simultaneously annihilate the disturbing elements in the progressive march of human civilization. In accordance with this principle of the transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he descended in his eternal form as Sri Krishna in the dynasty of the Yadus. The palace of Rukmini was wonderfully furnished. Hanging from the ceilings were many canopies with laces bedecked with pearl garlands, and the whole palace was illuminated by the effulgence of valuable jewels. There were many flower groves of Mallika and Chamali, which are considered the most fragrant flowers in India. There were many clusters of these plants with blooming flowers, enhancing the beauty of the palace. And because of the exquisite fragrance of the flowers, little groups of hummingbees gathered around the trees, and at night the pleasing moonshine glittered through the network of the holes in the windows. There were many heavily flowered trees of Parijata, and the mild wind stirred the fragrance of the flowers all around. Incense burned within the walls of the palace, and the fragrant smoke leaked out of the window shutters. Within the room were mattresses covered with white bedsheets. The bedding was as soft and white as milk foam, In this situation, Lord Sri Krishna sat very comfortably and enjoyed the service of Rukminiji, who was assisted by her maidservants. Rukmini was very eager to get the opportunity to serve her husband, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She therefore wanted to serve the Lord personally and took the handle of the chamara from the hand of the maidservant and began to move the fan. The handle of the chamara was made of gold and bedecked with valuable jewels, and it became more beautiful when taken by Rukmini because all of her fingers were beautifully set with jeweled rings. Her legs were decorated with jeweled ankle bells, which rang very softly between the pleats of her sari. Rukmini's raised breasts were smeared with kumkum and saffron. Thus her beauty was enhanced by the reflection of the reddish color emanating from her covered breasts. Her high hips were decorated with a jeweled lace girdle, and a locket of great effulgence hung on her neck. Above all, because she was engaged in the service of Lord Krishna, although at that time she was old enough to have grown-up sons, her beautiful body was beyond compare in the three worlds. When we take account of her beautiful face, it appears that the curling hair on her head, the beautiful earrings on her ears, her smiling mouth, and her necklace of gold all combined to shower rains of nectar, and thus it was definitely proved that Rukmini was none other than the original goddess of fortune, who's always engaged in the service of the lotus feet of Narayan. The pastimes of Krishna and Rukmini and Dwarka are accepted by great authorities as manifestations of those of Narayan and Lakshmi, which are of an exalted opulence. The pastimes of Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan are simple and rural, distinguished from the polished urban characteristics of those of Dwarka. The characteristics of Rukmini were unusually bright, and Krishna was very much satisfied with her behavior. Krishna had experienced that when Rukmini was offered a parijata flower by Narada Muni, Satyabhama had become envious of her co-wife and had immediately demanded a similar flower from Krishna. In fact, she could not be pacified until she was promised the whole tree. And Krishna actually fulfilled his promise. He brought the tree down to the earth planet from the heavenly kingdom. After this episode, Krishna expected that because Satyabhama had been rewarded with a full tree of parijata, Rukmini would also demand something. Rukmini did not mention anything of the incident, however, for she was grave and simply satisfied in her service. Krishna wanted to see her a bit irritated, and therefore he schemed to see the beautiful face of Rukmini in an irritated condition. Although Krishna had more than 16,100 wives, he used to behave with each of them with familial affection. He would create a particular situation between himself and his wife in which the wife would criticize him in irritation of love, and Krishna would enjoy this. In this case, because Krishna could not find any fault with Rukmini, for she was very grave and always engaged in his service, he smilingly, in great love, began to speak to her just to provoke her loving anger. Rukmini was the daughter of Bhishmaka, a powerful king. Thus, Krishna did not address her as Rukmini. He addressed her this time as the princess. My dear princess, it is very surprising. Many great personalities in the royal order wanted to marry you. Although not all of them were kings, all possessed the opulence and riches of the kingly order. They were well-behaved, learned, famous among kings, beautiful in their bodily features and personal qualifications, liberal, very powerful in strength, and advanced in every respect. They were not unfit in any way, and above that, your father and your brother had no objection to such a marriage. On the contrary, they gave their word of honor that you would be married with Sisupal. Indeed, the marriage was sanctioned by both your parents. Sisupal was a great king and was so lusty and mad after your beauty that if he had married you, I think he would have always remained with you just like a faithful servant. In comparison to Sisupal, with his personal qualities, I am nothing, and you may personally realize it. I am surprised that you rejected the marriage with Sisupal and accepted me, who am inferior in comparison to Sisupal. I think myself completely unfit to be your husband because you are so beautiful, sober, grave, and exalted. May I inquire from you the reason that induced you to accept me? Now, of course, I may address you as my beautiful wife, but still I may inform you of my actual position, that I am inferior to all those princes who wanted to marry you. First of all, you may know that I am so much afraid of... Actually, maybe I'm going to skip ahead then to where she starts speaking. Yeah, I think I'm going to do that. Because otherwise we'll never hear what she says. Okay, here we go. So this is... I'm just going to read... This is the last thing Krishna says, and then Rukmini speaks after this. As I've already explained, I'm not very much interested in family life or love between husband and wife. By nature, I'm not very fond of family life, wife, children, home, and opulence. As my devotees are always neglectful of these worldly possessions, I am also like that. Actually, I'm interested in self-realization. That gives me pleasure and not this family life. After submitting his statement, Lord Krishna suddenly stopped. The great authority Sukadeva Goswami remarks that Krishna almost always passed his time with Rukmini, and Rukmini was a bit proud to be so fortunate that Krishna never left her even for a moment. Krishna, however, did not like any of his devotees to be proud. As soon as a devotee becomes so, by some tactic, he cuts down that pride. In this case also, Krishna said many things which were hard for Rukmini to hear. She could only conclude that although she was proud of her position, Krishna could be separated from her at any moment. Okay. Rukmini was conscious that her husband was not an ordinary human being. He was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of the three worlds. By the way he was speaking, she was afraid of being separated from the Lord, for she had never heard such harsh words from Krishna before. And then she became perplexed with fear of separation, and her heart began to palpitate. Without replying to a word of Krishna's statements, she simply cried in anxiety, as if drowning in an ocean of grief. She silently scratched the floor with her toenails, which reflected reddish light on the floor. The tears from her eyes mixed with the black cosmic ointment from her eyelids and dropped down, washing the kumkum and saffron from her breasts. Choked up on account of great anxiety, unable to speak even a word, she kept her head downward and remained standing just like a stick. Due to extremely painful fear and lamentation, she lost all her powers of reason and became weak, her body losing so much weight that the bangles on her wrists became slack. The chama with which she was serving Krishna immediately fell from her hand. Her brain and memory became puzzled, and she lost consciousness. The nicely combed hair on her head scattered here and there, and she fell down straight like a banana tree cut down by a whirlwind. Lord Krishna immediately realized that Rukmini had not taken his words in a joking spirit. She had taken them seriously, and in her extreme anxiety over immediate separation from him, she had fallen into this condition. Lord Sri Krishna is naturally very affectionate toward his devotees, and when he saw Rukmini's condition, his heart immediately softened. At once he became merciful to her. The relationship between Rukmini and Krishna was like that between Lakshmi and Narayan. Therefore, Krishna appeared before Rukmini in his four-handed manifestation of Narayan. He got down from the bedstead, lifted her up by her hands, and placed his cooling hands on her face, smoothed the scattering hair on her head. Lord Krishna dried the wet breasts of Rukmini with his hand. Understanding the seriousness of Rukmini's love for him, he embraced her to his chest. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is expert in putting a thing reasonably for one's understanding, and thus he tried to retract all that he had said before. He is the only resort for all devotees, and so he knows very well how to satisfy his pure devotees. Krishna understood that Rukmini could not follow the statements he had made in a joking way. To counteract her confusion, he spoke as follows. Okay, I'm going to read this because I'm just speaking shortly after that. Okay. My dear daughter of King Vidarbha, my dear Rukmini, please do not misunderstand me. Do not be unkind to me like this. I know that you are sincerely and seriously attached to me. You are my eternal and you are my eternal companion. The words which have affected you so much are not factual. I wanted to irritate you a bit, and I was thus expecting you to make counter answers to these joking words. Unfortunately, you have taken them seriously. I am very sorry for that. I expected that your red lips would tremble in anger when you heard my statement, and that you would chastise me with many words. O perfection of love, I never expected your condition would be like this. I expected that you would cast your blinking glance upon me in retaliation, and that I would thus be able to see your beautiful face in that angry mood. My dear beautiful wife, you know that because we are householders, we are always busy in many household affairs and long for a time when we can enjoy some joking words between us. That is our ultimate gain in household life. End quote. Actually, householders work very hard day and night, but all fatigue of the day's labor is minimized as soon as they meet husband and wife together and enjoy life in many ways. Lord Krishna wanted to exhibit himself as being like an ordinary householder who delights himself by exchanging joking words with his wife. He therefore repeatedly requested Rukmini not to take those words very seriously. In this way, when Lord Krishna pacified Rukmini by his sweet words, she could understand that that what he had formerly said was not actually meant seriously, but was spoken to evoke some joking pleasure between themselves. She was therefore pacified by hearing the words of Krishna. Gradually, she was freed from all fear of separation from him, and she began to look at his face very cheerfully and with her naturally smiling face. She said, "My dear lotus-eyed Lord, your statement that we are not a fit combination is completely right. It is not possible for me to come it's not possible for me to come to an equal level with you, for you are the reservoir of all qualities, the unlimited supreme personality of Godhead. How can I be a fit match for you? There is no possibility of comparison with you, who are the master of all greatness, the controller of the three qualities, and the object of worship for great demigods like Brahma and Shiva. As far as I am concerned, I am a product of the three modes of material nature, which impede the progressive advancement of devotional service. When and where can I be a fit match for you? My dear husband, you have rightly said that you have taken shelter in the water of the sea as if you were afraid of the kings. But who are the kings of this material world? I do not think that the so-called royal families are kings of the material world. The kings of the material world are the three modes of material nature, who are actually its controllers. You are situated in the core of everyone's heart, where you remain completely aloof from the touch of the three modes of material nature, and therefore there is no doubt about it. You say you always maintain enmity with worldly kings, but who are the worldly kings? I think the worldly kings are the senses. They are most formidable, and they control everyone. Certainly you maintain enmity with these material senses. You are never under the control of the senses. Rather, you are the control of the senses, Rishikesh. My dear Lord, you have said that you are bereft of all royal power, and that is also correct. Not only are you bereft of supremacy over the material world, but even your servants, those who have some attachment to your lotus feet, also give up supremacy over the material world because they consider the material position to be the darkest region which checks the progress of spiritual advancement, spiritual enlightenment. Your servants do not like material supremacy, so what to speak of you? My dear Lord, your statement that you do not act as an ordinary person with a particular aim in life is also perfectly correct. Even your great devotees and servants, known as great sages and saintly persons, remain in such a state that no one can get any clue as to their aim, as to the aim of their lives. Human society considers them crazy and cynical. Their aim of life remains a mystery to the common human being. The lowest of mankind can know neither you nor your servants. A contaminated human being cannot even imagine the pastimes of you and your devotees. O unlimited one, when the activities and endeavors of your devotees remain a mystery to the common man, to the common human beings, how can your motives and endeavors be understood by them? All kinds of energies and opulences are engaged in your service, but still, they rest at your shelter. You have described yourself as penniless, but this condition is not poverty. Since there is nothing in existence but you, you do not need to possess anything. You yourself are everything. Unlike others, you do not require to purchase anything extraneously. With you, all contrary things can be adjusted because you are absolute. You do not possess anything, but no one is richer than you. In the material world, no one can be rich without possessing. Since your lordship is absolute, you can adjust the contradiction of possessing nothing, but at the same time being the richest. In the Vedas it is stated that although you have no material hands and legs, you accept everything offered in devotion by the devotees. You have no material eyes and ears, but still you can see and hear everything everywhere. Although you do not possess anything, the great demigods who accept prayers and worship from others come and worship you to solicit your mercy. How can you be categorized among the poor? My dear Lord, you have also stated that the richest section of human society does not worship you. This is also correct, because persons who are puffed up with material possessions think of utilizing their property for sense gratification. When a poverty-stricken man becomes rich, he makes a program for sense gratification due to his ignorance of how to utilize his hard-earned money. Under the spell of the external energy, he thinks that his money is properly employed in sense gratification, and thus he neglects to render you transcendental service. My dear Lord, you have stated that persons who possess nothing are very dear to you. Renouncing everything, your devotee wants to possess you only. I see, therefore, that a great sage like Narada Muni, who does not possess any material property, is still very dear to you. And such persons do not care for anything but your lordship. My dear Lord, you have stated that a marriage between persons equal in social standing, beauty, riches, strength, influence, and renunciation can be a suitable match. But this status of life can be possible only by your grace. You are the supreme perfectional source of all opulences. Whatever opulent status one may have is all derived from you. As described in the Vedanta Sutra, Janmadyasya Yataha, you are the supreme source from which everything emanates, the reservoir of all pleasures. Therefore, persons endowed with knowledge desire only to achieve you and nothing else. To achieve your favor, they give up everything, even the transcendental realization of Brahman. You are the supreme, ultimate goal of life. You are the reservoir of all interests of all living entities. Those who are actually well-motivated desire only you, and for this reason they give up everything to attain success. They therefore deserve to associate with you. In the society of the servitors and the served in Krishna consciousness, one is not subjected to the pains and pleasures of material society, which functions according to sex attraction. Therefore, everyone, whether man or woman, should seek to be an associate in your society of servitors and served. You are the supreme personality of Godhead. No one can excel you, nor can anyone come up to, nor can anyone come up to an equal level with you. The perfect social system is that in which you remain in the center, being served as the supreme, and all others engage as your servitors. In such a perfectly constructed society, everyone can remain eternally happy and blissful. My Lord, you have stated that only the beggars praise your glories, and that is also perfectly correct. But who are those beggars? Those beggars are exalted devotees, liberated personalities, and those in the renounced order of life. They are all great souls and devotees who have no other business than to glorify you. Such great souls forgive even the worst offenders. These so-called beggars execute their spiritual advancement in life, tolerating all tribulations in the material world. My dear husband, do not think that I accept you as my husband out of my inexperience. Actually, I followed all these great souls. I followed the path of these great beggars and decided to surrender my life unto your lotus feet. You have said that you are penniless, and that is correct, for you distribute yourself completely to these souls, great souls and devotees. Knowing this fact perfectly well, I rejected even such great personalities as Lord Brahma and King Indra. My Lord, the great time factor acts under your direction only. The time factor is so great and powerful that within moments it can affect devastation anywhere within the creation. Considering all these factors, I thought Jarasandha, Sisupal, and similar princes who wanted to marry me to be no more important than ordinary insects. My dear all-powerful son of Vasudev, your statement that you have taken shelter within the water of the ocean out of fear for all the great princes is quite unsuitable. For my experience with you contradicts this. I have actually seen that you kidnapped me forcibly in the presence of all these princes. At the time of my marriage ceremony, simply by giving a jerk to the string of your bow, you very easily drove the others away and kindly gave me shelter at your lotus feet. I still remember vividly how you kidnapped me in the same way that a lion forcibly takes its share of hunted booty, driving away all small animals with the twinkling of an eye. My dear lotus-eyed Lord, I cannot understand your statements that women and other persons have taken shelter under your lotus feet past their days and only in bereavement. From the history of the world, we can see that princes like Anga, Prithu, Bharat, Yayati, and Gaya were all great emperors of the world, and they were no competitors to their exalted positions. But in order to achieve the favor of your lotus feet, they renounced their exalted positions and entered the forest to practice penances and austerities. When they voluntarily accepted such a position, accepting your lotus feet as all in all, does it mean that they were in lamentation and bereavement? My dear Lord, you have advised me that I can still select another from the princely order and divorce myself from your companionship. But, my dear Lord, it is perfectly well known to me that you are the reservoir of all good qualities. Great saintly persons like Narada Muni are always engaged simply in glorifying your transcendental characteristics. Someone who simply takes shelter of such a saintly person immediately becomes freed from all material contamination. And when he comes in direct contact with your service, the goddess of fortune agrees to bestow all her blessings. Under the circumstances, what woman who has once heard of your glories from authoritative sources and has somehow or other relished the nectarian fragrance of your lotus feet would be foolish enough to agree to marry someone of this material world who is always afraid of death, disease, old age, and rebirth. I have therefore accepted your lotus feet not without consideration, but after mature and deliberate decision. My dear Lord, you are the master of the three worlds. You can fulfill all the desires of all your devotees in this world and the next because you are the super soul of everyone. I have therefore selected you as my husband, considering you to be the only fit personality. You may throw me in any species of life according to the reactions of my fruitive activities, and I haven't the least concern for this. My only ambition is that I might always remain fast to your lotus feet, for you can deliver your devotees from illusory material existence and are always prepared to distribute yourself to the devotees. Let's see if I should stop or finish. Well, let's see. There's 1, 2, 3 pages left. Should I keep going? I'll go to 8:30 and then we'll stop. How's that sound? Okay. My dear Lord, you have advised me to select one of such princes as Sisupal, Jarasandha, or Dantavakra, but what is their position in this world? They're always engaged in hard labor to maintain their household life, just like bulls working hard day and night with an oil-pressing machine. They are compared to asses, beasts of burden. They are always dishonored like dogs, and they are miserly like cats. They have sold themselves like slaves to their wives. Any unfortunate woman who has never heard of your glories may accept such a man as her husband, but a woman who has learned about you, that you are praised not only in this world, but in the halls of the great demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, will not accept anyone besides you as her husband. A man within this material world is just a dead body. In fact, superficially, the living entity is covered by this body, which is nothing but a bag of skin, decorated with a beard and a mustache, hairs on the head, nails on the fingers, and hairs on the head. Within this decorated bag are bunches of muscles, bundles of bones, and pools of blood, always mixed with stool, urine, mucus, bile, and polluted air, and enjoyed by different kinds of insects and germs. A foolish woman accepts such a dead body as her husband, and in sheer misunderstanding loves him as her dear companion. This is possible only because such a woman has never relished the ever-blissful fragrance of your lotus feet. My dear lotus-eyed husband, you are self-satisfied. You do not care whether or not I am beautiful or qualified. You are not at all concerned about it. Therefore, your non-attachment for me is not at all astonishing. It is quite natural. You cannot be attached to any woman, however exalted her position and beauty. Whether you are attached to me or not, may my devotion and attention be always engaged at your lotus feet. The material motive passion is also your creation. So when you passionately glance upon me, I accept it as the greatest boon of my life. I am ambitious only for such auspicious moments. After hearing Rukmini's statement for her clarification of each and every word he had used to arouse her anger and love toward him, Krishna addressed Rukmini as follows. My dear chaste wife, my dear princess, I expected such an explanation from you, and only for this purpose that I speak all those joking words so that you may be cheated of the cheated of the real point of view. Now my purpose has been served. The wonderful explanation you have given of my every word is completely factual and approved by me. O most beautiful Rukmini, you are my dearmost wife. I am greatly pleased to understand how much love you have for me. Please take it for granted that no matter what ambition and desire you might have, and no matter what you might expect from me, I am always at your service. And it is a fact also that my devotees, my dearmost friends and servitors, are always free from material contamination, even though they are not inclined to ask me for such liberation. My devotees never desire anything from me and except to be engaged in my service, and yet because they are completely dependent upon me, even if they are found to ask something from me, that is not material. Such ambitions and desires, instead of becoming the cause of material bondage, become the source of liberation from this material world. My dear chaste and pious wife, I have tested on the basis of strict chastity your love for your husband, and you have passed the examination most successfully. I have purposely agitated you by speaking many words not applicable to your character, but I am surprised to see that not a pinch of your devotion to me has been deviated from its fixed position. My dear wife, I am the bestower of all benedictions, even up to the standard of liberation from this material world. And it is I only who can stop the continuation of material existence and call one back home, back to Godhead. One whose devotion for me is adulterated worships me for some material benefit, just to keep himself in the material world in the world of material happiness, culminating in the pleasure of sex life. One who engages himself in severe penances and austerities just to attain this material happiness is certainly under the illusion of my external energy. Persons who are engaged in my devotional service simply for the purpose of material gain and sense gratification are certainly very foolish. For material happiness based on sex life is available in the most abominable species of life, such as the hogs and dogs. No one should try to approach me for such happiness, which is available even if one is put into hellish a hellish condition of life. It is better, therefore, for persons who are simply after material happiness and not after me to attain... It is better, therefore, for persons who are simply after material happiness and not after me to remain in that hellish condition. Material contamination is so strong that everyone is working very hard day and night for material happiness. The show of religion, austerity, penance, humanitarianism, philanthropy, politics, science, and everything is aimed at realizing some material benefit. For the immediate success of material benefit, materialistic persons generally worship different demigods, and under the spell of material propensities, they sometimes take to the devotional service of the Lord. But sometimes it so happens that if a person sincerely serves the Lord and at the same time maintains material ambitions, the Lord very kindly removes the sources of material happiness. Not finding any recourse in material happiness, the devotee then engages himself absolutely in pure devotional service. Lord Krishna continued, "My dear best of queens, I clearly understand that you have no material ambition. Your only purpose is to serve me, and you have long been engaged in unalloyed service. Exemplary unalloyed devotional service not only can bestow upon the devotee liberation from this material world, but it also promotes him to the spiritual world to be eternally engaged in my service. Persons too much addicted to material happiness cannot render such service. Women whose hearts are polluted and full of material desires devise various means of sense gratification while outwardly showing themselves to be great devotees. My dear honored wife, although I have thousands of wives, I do not think that any one of them can love me more than you. The practical proof of your extraordinary position is that although you had never seen me before our marriage and had simply heard about me from a third person, still your faith in me was so much fixed that even in the presence of many qualified, rich and beautiful men of the royal order, you did not select any of the princes present, and very politely you sent me a confidential letter inviting me to kidnap you. While I was kidnapping you, your elder brother Rukmini violently protested and fought with me. As a result of the fight, I defeated him mercilessly and disfigured his body. At the time of Aniruddha's marriage, when we were all playing chess, there was another fight with your brother Rukmini on a controversial verbal point, and my elder brother Balaram finally killed him. I was surprised to see that you did not utter even a word of protest over this incident, because of your great anxiety that you might be separated from me. You suffered all the consequences without speaking even a word. As a result of this great silence, my dear wife, you have purchased me for all time. I have come eternally under your control. You sent your messenger inviting me to kidnap you, and when you found that there was a little delay in my arriving on the spot, you saw the whole world is vacant. At that time, you concluded that your beautiful body was not fit to be touched by anyone else. Therefore, thinking that I was not coming, you decided to commit suicide and immediately end that body. My dear Rukmini, such great and exalted love for me will always remain within my soul. As far as I am concerned, it is not within my power to repay you for your unalloyed devotion to me." Just a couple paragraphs more. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna certainly has no business being anyone's husband or son or father, because everything belongs to him and everyone is under his control. He does not require anyone's help for his satisfaction. He is Atmarama, self-satisfied. He can derive all pleasure by himself without anyone's help. But when the Lord descends to play the part of a human being, he plays a role either as a husband, son, friend, or enemy in full perfection. As such, when he was playing as the perfect husband of the queens, especially Rukminiji, he enjoyed conjugal love in complete perfection. According to Vedic culture, although polygamy is allowed, none of one's wives should be ill-treated. In other words, one may take many wives only if he is able to satisfy all of them equally as an ideal householder. Otherwise, it is not allowed. Lord Krishna is the world teacher. Therefore, even though he had no need for a wife, he expanded himself into as many forms as he had wives, and he lived with them as an ideal householder, observing the regulative principles, rules, and commitments in accordance with the Vedic injunctions and the social laws and customs of society. For each of his 16,108 wives, he simultaneously maintained different palaces, different establishments, and different atmospheres. Thus the Lord, although one, exhibited himself as 16,108 ideal householders. Thus ends the Bhaktivinoda purport of the 60th chapter of Krishna Talks Between Krishna and Rukmini. Jai, Shri Rukmini Ki Jai.